We're about to have a conversation with Fida Kishta, who has made this incredible movie called Where Should the Birds Fly? She came to Baltimore to show it at the 2640 Space. She is a filmmaker from Gaza, a Palestinian filmmaker, who's made a most remarkable film. And if you didn't see it when she was here, then you missed something, but you should see it when you can. And Fida, welcome to the studio. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So and let me just describe. Well, let me let you do it, not me. You do this. Describe for our listeners this film and how you came to it. You're from Gaza?
Yes.
So talk,
originally from Gaza.
And I remember in the story how after witnessing things, you felt you had a need to just get a camera and start telling the story.
Yes. I lived in Gaza. I was born and raised in Gaza. And I lived in a neighborhood where things constantly happening and things are changing all the time. And sometimes I really felt the need to document what's happening there. Where Should the Birds Fly is basically a document about what's happening in Gaza, in particular my neighborhood or people I interacted with, farmers, fishermen, or families who lost a member of their extended family or loving ones.
What you did with this film, I just want to, I mean, it, to me, this film is different than other documentary films that I've seen, whether they're about Palestine or any place else, in that, I gotta describe this. This to me was a very personal film. This is not like a detached filmmaker coming in to make a film about a subject. I mean, this was, you were the film, and this little child Mona was the film, and the people who were living in Gaza, who are your family and friends, they were the film.
Yes. Actually, what made me as a Palestinian make this film, I worked as an interpreter for years with journalists who come and make films and just leave. In 2 weeks, they shoot the story. I see them working and then go and tell the story for just a person who came for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And just meet families and talk about their experiences. And I felt that these are not really good enough to express what people go through. It's basically for a journalist who come, but they do not really know the people. They know the people for 2 weeks, but it's not enough time to tell the story for these people who are going through a lot. And 2 weeks, even a month, even 2 months, even a year is not enough to tell a story of people, their life constantly changing.
I understand what you're saying. One cannot just, as they say in the United States, can't parachute in for a minute and then walk away and think you have the entire story.
Exactly.
Right?
And it's not enough time for people to open up to you. People open up at the moment, but then there are lots of things people can share with you if you give them more time. And living there made me actually see what people can share. They can share a lot. They can share a meal, drink, a long conversation, a dance with you. They invite you to their homes. You become part of the whole circle they have, despite the fact that lots of terrible things happening, but they are very generous people.
The poet Mahmoud Darwish writes, I look out like a balcony on what I want. I look out on the wind searching for its homeland in itself. What will happen? What will happen after the ashes? These are Palestinian stories. It is my story and the story of Mona Samouni, two young women of Gaza.
When I said it was a very personal film, I mean, because you are Palestinian, you are Gazan, and you shot it from the inside with the people, but also it was very personal because it was your journey as a filmmaker, as your first film, to kind of come out and we watched you kind of grow into the movie in a sense.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So there are certain scenes in here whether you've lived in the middle of violence or not, it's hard to become annoyed to it, hard to become separate from it, you know? And when you were interviewing that young boy who was shot in the who was hit by a phosphorus bomb, and the Israelis have all said that we're not using phosphorus bombs, but this boy who was burned and shot, and you shot it in the hospital. I mean, and then the pictures you took of all the people who were wounded in the street and who were bloodied and dead and dying or badly wounded. I mean, how was that for you? As a filmmaker and as a filmmaker who is not dispassionate, not separate from the people that you're filming?
Well, at some point, I was disattached from the people I was filming for one reason, that when you shoot lots of bloody scenes, it somehow in your brain it becomes part of the whole situation. But one of the things that I personally experienced, looking through a small monitor on the camera, make a huge difference for the way I saw the injuries. For example, when I was in the hospital, I was filming, actually it's not included in this film, but there were two patients in the hospital that are totally, their body totally messed up. I found myself that I don't look to them directly. I look just into the small monitor in the camera, the small screen in the camera. And to be honest, it made a huge difference in the way that I was thinking about their injuries. But when it came to Ayman in the movie, it was a huge difference. I know Ayman. I work with the farmers. I have a close relationship to them. I cried when I was filming Ayman, and I held my tears.
Which is the name of the little boy who was,
yes, who was
full of holes and
in the back,
and,
yeah.
Yeah.
It was totally different because knowing Ayman is not like going to a hospital and film a lot of people that I cannot say I don't know. I know them, Palestinian from this city or that city, but it's totally different from Ayman, that I totally know his village, worked with the farmers in his village, know his family. It was totally different. And I remember when I saw his, when the doctor took the Band-Aid from his back, that's when I saw the runny blood comes out, and I felt really, really the need of just cry it out. And at that moment, I saw myself just not making sound, because I knew if the sound comes on the camera, it's going to be a mess. Because as a filmmaker, if your voice comes out, then you have two ways. You could affect people, and in the other hand, also, it's not a professional. I am totally messed up with what happened to him, but I had to hold back.
Israel's war on Gaza began without warning on December 27, 2008, with a massive F-16 and drone assault. Israel has attacked Gaza hundreds of times in the last decade, but the scale and destructiveness of this assault was unprecedented. They called it Operation Cast Lead. We call it a massacre.
So do you live in Gaza now?
I live in New York now.
You live in New York now.
Yeah.
And you go back and forth frequently?
Not really. I mean, in the last few years, it's been really horrible. I tried to see my family last summer, and it didn't work out because of the closure, but also my family couldn't leave. I couldn't make it to Europe where we're supposed to meet. It was very complicated. It's not an easy situation. And also, the war on Gaza happened in July, and things totally changed in the terms of seeing my family. But it's not an easy thing to go in or out from Gaza because of the crossing. Rafah crossing is basically closed most of the time.
Which, as you said in the film, was the only real crossing, only way out for the Gazans and for the Palestinians who live in Gaza. And one of the things that you said in the film when you were narrating was that the biggest issue in Gaza is not all the things you can talk about, but it's the fact that it's a prison. The people are imprisoned in this peace. And I think you get that sense from your film, but it's the sense, I think, that people don't understand in a visceral sense, you know what I mean? These outsiders don't understand.
Yeah, because they do not see what's exactly happening there when it comes to how people feel trapped inside a small place like Gaza, 1.7 million people. You cannot travel anywhere. And if you come in, you cannot leave. You have really to have a huge coordination for your life to be able to visit Gaza or leave from Gaza. If you are a student, got a scholarship somewhere, and then you need to go. You are really, really in a difficult mental pressure, psychological pressure. Am I going to get this scholarship? Am I going to my school or not? Inside Gaza itself, what is allowed to enter, what is not allowed to enter in terms of food, in terms of a product, who's ruling in Gaza, who's controlling people, what people can do, what people cannot do, what people allow to do, what people not allowed to do. So all of this stuff inside Gaza is not what people know here. I mean, they know nothing. You take a plane from a place to another, and it's easy. I do it here in the United States now all the time when people invite me to talk.
Right.
So I take the plane. I go to the airport. Here's my documents. Everything is just fine. You even show them the ID, and you get into the plane. You go to the other city. It's very human. It's very civilized the way you are being treated, despite the fact lots of Americans are not liking the system of searching and the machines and airports, and they feel it's too much. If they feel it's too much, they should really look at
come to Gaza
just for one day to see the checkpoints or the crossings. I mean, we don't have checkpoints right now in Gaza, lots of them, but we have crossings that really eliminate people movement.
Coming back to what we were just talking about, one of the things that I think is important about this film also is that you did not focus on the political leadership. You didn't focus on the people who govern from Hamas or from Fatah and the other side. You focused on the citizens, the people. And I think Mona's brother, I think it was, when he was describing what it was like to be stopped by Israeli soldiers and moved from their home into this place, and he described himself, when the Israeli soldier asked him, "Are you part of Hamas?" after they made him lift his shirt and pull his pants down to make sure he had no weapons or whatever they were doing. He said, "If I was from Hamas, I wouldn't have walked over here. I'd have run away." I remember that. That was really struck me.
Mm-hmm.
And that you decided to focus in on the people, the everyday working people, families inside of Gaza.
Yeah. Because what matters for me as Palestinian is the people. The leadership is always on the TV, is always on the news, with a negative or positive thing. They are always there. You hear about them. But most of the time, you do not hear about people in Gaza. You do not hear about a student who's being killed when he in his way to school. You do not hear about farmers are being shot while they are harvesting.
Yeah.
Or you do not hear about fishermen when they are just going in a normal day on their boat, just trying to fish. Those are things that people anywhere can have simply rights for. Just do your job. That's your job. You are an engineer. You do your job. You are a farmer. You do your job. People take it for granted here. They think everybody else in the world just live the way they think is okay here to live. But there they are not. A farmer cannot reach their farm just like that. It's not a simple thing. And they matter a lot to me because I'm an activist as well. And I work with these simple people. Those people are all I knew in Gaza. I mean, political leadership is, excuse me to say the word, always... I'm sad to say it, but it's not the people I look at. I do not look at the political leadership to change huge things in any country in the terms of changing when it comes to people's lives. So that's why I took care of, in this film, I took care of the people I came from. I came from a middle-class family. I tell the poor and middle-class people stories that who have no voice to tell their own story. They do not have a voice. Most of the time when they tell you what they go through, they tell you because you are one of them. They feel connection. And I felt connection.
Mm-hmm.
That's the connection where I felt. I felt with those people. I don't feel a connection with a leader in this political party or that party.
Right, right.
I do not feel that connection.
That was what you're describing now is what is so extremely powerful about this movie. that we had the conversation actually the other day about another film made by a black man talking to black people about their film and his film. And he said, Stanley Nelson said that this person would never have said that had I been a white filmmaker. And it was the same feeling I got watching your film, because the way people talk to you was you would not get that from a European coming in, or an American coming in, or an Israeli coming in to do the same film, because that made the difference in this film, I think, in a lot of ways.
A woman told me that I should meet a 10-year-old girl named Mona. 2 weeks earlier, she had lost 21 members of her extended family. I thought to myself, what can a 10-year-old say? But this girl shocked me when she started to talk. Although she spoke without emotion, she was incredibly articulate. She seemed so old beyond her years. Every time I visited, Mona took me back to Wael's house where her family was killed. I think that Mona, like all of us in Gaza, is numbed by the destruction of our lives. So we keep repeating with more detail what has happened to us. We hope that others will hear and this will bring change. Even though we know that if you are listening and that any justice will have to be won by the Palestinians themselves.
But let's talk about, before we run out of time, let's talk about Mona. Her way of speaking so articulately and almost dispassionately, but you know, I was stunned. I called my youngest daughter into the room and said, sit, you've got to watch this little girl. Talk a bit about her.
When I went to Zaytun neighborhood, I went with a few of my friends. They are internationals as well. And we actually, at first, we were interested about a group of women were sitting on the rubbles and discussing things that happened at that day in particular in their neighborhood, in a Zaytun neighborhood. And then this woman comes and she talks about how many member of a Samuni family were killed. And she actually guide us to see where exactly the incident happened and how many people were killed. And then she points to her niece and she says, look, she lost both of her parents. And she keeps walking. And then we meet Mona and she said, Mona also lost both of her parents. When she introduced me to Mona, I was shocked the way Mona was dressed, the way Mona was walking. And I grew up in those areas as well. And I know this is not normal because you go in a neighborhood, it's full of destruction. Other kids were very messed up. Their clothes, their faces, they are not really taking care of themselves. And Mona was the only kid was wearing really nice clothes, wearing boots on those rubble, and she had a bag. I was struck by the way Mona was dressed. And I thought, this kid may be kind of like a visiting kid who's very from a very elegant neighborhood or just coming to look at the destruction. But in fact, when the woman mentioned that she lost both of her parents, that was a big thing to me. And then I approached Mona, start to talk to her about what happened. Mona started to speak, and when she started to speak, that was, I remember how careless I was, not about the story, but I wasn't really expecting a lot from Mona. 10-year-old, what you expect from a child 10-year-old? So Mona stands and started to tell the story, and my actually camera was shaky. I wasn't really holding tight into my camera and expecting to get professional images. It's like she started to talk, let it be. It's a therapy for her, a therapy for me, listen and just do it. And when she talked about her parents, she remembered every single detail about how many missiles hit the house. Each missile killed who from her family, when each missile hit the house, what part of the house the missile hit. That was incredibly beyond my expectation. I was in the university when our house was destroyed. And there are lots of details I don't remember about how the
Had them all.
But she had them all. And I was shocked. So I sticked with her because she's the whole story that can be told out.
She's going to be an incredible woman when she grows up.
I hope if she lands in the right hands.
I hope so, yes. I mean, she was just do you stay in touch with her?
I talked to her a few times after the third war in Gaza, and sometimes I get through to her, but sometimes she's in a school. Depends on the time, the time change from New York to Gaza.
Even the presence of international observers does not prevent daily random Israeli gunfire. The Israelis seem to be playing a deadly game with Palestinians who are just trying to work and live. Taunting them and intimidating them, sometimes killing them. Sometimes they let the farmers actually plant and cultivate their crops, but then shoot at them when they try to harvest.
I think you also got the thing that came through them in the film I want people to get a sense of, because you saw the destruction and people being hurt. You saw what happened to the fishermen being confronted actually illegally by the Israeli Navy every time they just tried to fish. That was an incredibly powerful scene. When you listen to the fishermen, when you listen to Mona's brother, when you listen to some of the others that you talk to and the farmers in the fields attempting to just get the plant or to get food put out, I mean to pull out the plants, that you touched the deep humaneness and gentleness of the Palestinian people in Gaza. And I think that is so, to me and for Americans to see, is so incredibly important, because the image we have of Palestinians is the opposite in this country.
That's the problem, because people do not see the real people who live there. I mean, as any country or any place, you could find good people and bad people. And also, I am not with the term of good people and bad people. It's just the description that people use. I'm with the term of good behavior and bad behavior. A human being can do lots of good stuff, but the same human being could do a lot of terrible stuff. And in Gaza, there are lots of gentle people, nice people. You look at just the side of those extremists who actually do not mess it for others only, but they mess it as well for the people in Gaza. This thing that they is not here. Your media treats the Gaza as a whole thing, and all people are right. Really terrible extremists. They want to destroy the whole entire area around them. Farmers are farmers. Fishermen are fishermen. Students are students. Why would you look to a student as a tourist? Why would you look at the farmer as a tourist? Why do you look at a mother loving her child as a tourist? A mother in Gaza is the same as any mother anywhere. There is no mother would love to see her child 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20-year old or girl just get killed in front of them and cheer for it. A sick mother would do anywhere. A sick mother in Gaza would do as well. But a mother who's loving her family, like here or in Gaza, it's going to be the same result. A mother here is a mother there. Again, a professional here is a professional there. Teacher, engineer, doctor, it's the same. Why would people look at the whole place as a terrible people?
You know, I want to say this before we conclude, that just to tell you this, that I have been involved in the world between Palestinians and Israelis since the 1960s, a long time. And I've seen a lot of films, a lot of documentary films about the subject from different perspectives. And I will say, Fida, that I've never seen one that grabbed me like this, because of you, the filmmaker, being part of the people themselves, telling a story about human beings and their lives in a way that kind of just lays it out for any human being to understand, and makes the Palestinian fishermen and the Palestinian mother and father in the home that they just lost with their family be our next-door neighbors. You've done an incredible job, so I want to thank you for this film.
Do you mind if I mention one thing on the radio show?
Please do.
I'm I made this film, Where Should the Birds Fly, without any kind of prior education. I have a goal in May to go back to school for my graduate school. And I'm fundraising right on online right now. If people like the film or would like to see the film, they can contact me. My fundraising link online, GoFundMe/FIDA-school.
FIDA,
I would appreciate it.
FIDA.
FIDA, FIDA.
And also the link for your website.
It's videographyspeaks.com as well as whereshouldthebirdsfly.com.
And we will link to all of those things on our website. And Fida Kishta, with the birds, Where Should the Birds Fly. Thank you so much for this film and for coming, making your time to come by our studios today.
Thank you for having
me. It's an honor
me.
To have you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Ha ha ha!